This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. We'll start today with a veteran and a Gold Star father. Events in Afghanistan are hitting close to home for both of them here in Massachusetts. John Velas is a state senator and served in Afghanistan in the summer of 2018. And Steve Exaros is a state representative and a Gold Star father. His oldest son, Nicholas, died at the age of 21 on the battlefield in Afghanistan on July 23, 2009. We reached both legislators earlier today, and we began with Senator Velas's reaction to the scenes from Kabul.
Oh, it's tough. It's heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching. Some of the images that were flashed, you know, with the Taliban right outside of the U.S. embassy, where I've spent a lot of time in Kabul, and then being at a table in the presidential palace, a place that I've been to many times, at that table, sitting down, having conversations with members of the Afghan government, trying to get to a place where we could have a peaceful resolution to Afghanistan and Afghans could live a great, prosperous life. To see the Taliban occupying that table and outside of our embassy, again, heart-wrenching to say the least. With respect to the people that are there, I just find it morally reprehensible, really is the only phrase that I could use to describe it. When you have so many people that did so many things for us. I mean, 2 days ago, I was speaking to a linguist who is in Afghanistan right now, still obviously, and he was crying on the phone and he said, I have been left behind. And he was explaining to me that the Taliban, as we were on the phone, were going around knocking on doors, you know, checking cell phones, checking paperwork. So, I mean, we have a moral obligation to get those individuals who helped us outside of that country.
So these folks who you fought alongside with, these Afghan allies, right, as you said, linguists, interpreters, anyone else who provided aid to the U.S. military or served in the Afghan government, you're the author of this letter to federal colleagues signed by some 70 Massachusetts legislators saying that we must make every effort to get our Afghan allies out. Have you heard from any of our delegation? What's the movement on that?
Yeah, I've been in constant conversations with members of the delegation in their offices. They get it. They understand it. I'm not 100% convinced that the average person back here in America, in Massachusetts, understands the true sacrifice of these linguists and cultural advisors. And kind of just to give you another example, I spoke with another linguist who I worked closely with back in 2012, 2013. And at the base that I was stationed at, it was FOB Smart. And right outside of that base on April 6, 2013, a day that will forever be kind of stitched in my mind. There was a foot patrol of U.S. service members, as well as obviously Afghan linguists, translators, and foreign service officers. In fact, the attack that ensued, which was a car bomb, three U.S. service members, the first foreign service officer, only foreign service officer that was killed in Afghanistan, Anne Smedinghoff, as well as an Afghan doctor. This linguist that I was talking to was on that foot patrol on April 6, 2013, and he got blown up, broke several bones in his body, and he's now living to tell the story. He has since been relocated here, but he's got family members over there. He's got fellow linguists over there. So these aren't people that stayed back on the base as U.S. service members kind of walked out and did their thing. They were right next to us as we were doing it. I offer that really just to say that they were right next to us, walking with us, unarmed, throughout the streets of Afghanistan. And
serving,
I always
with
say
you, really.
This, 100%, 100%. I firmly believe that we need to get all of these people out of this country.
So let's talk about sacrifice, Representative Exaros. Can we talk about your son, Nicholas, killed in action in 2009? Served in the Marines in Afghanistan, and maybe you hear this a lot, but I do want to say it. I'm sorry for your loss.
Hey, thank you. These are tough times, but I just so impressed with Senator Velas. You know, we're talking with an American hero. So when he speaks with credibility. My son, Nick, you know, would have been someone like him. He loved his country. He was just a boy, you know, that like a lot of others that, you know, played baseball and football. And he was the big brother to three others, you know, Ashlyn, Elizabeth, my twin daughters, and Alex, his little baby brother. He was like a big brother to everybody. And on September 11th, when we were attacked by these evil people, he was 13. And I remember the moment. A day later, we were walking through a supermarket, and he pulled me aside. He said, "Dad, I'm gonna be a Marine, and I'm gonna fight for our country." And you know, he was only 13, and I felt immediate like pride, but also worry. When he turned 17, he went to the recruiter, not them finding him. He went to their office. And you know, there's a moment I'll never forget when, almost like a movie scene, a Marine in the dress blues is sitting in my kitchen with my wife and I and, you know, 17-year-old Nick, and asking us to sign the papers because he was so young. My hand wouldn't move when I had the pen in my hand. And I signed those papers, and he went on to graduate high school. And a week later, he was at boot camp, and we couldn't wait to get letters from him. You know, they don't call home. They write letters. And we would wait by the mailbox. We were so proud, and we still are. And despite, you know, what's happening and what we see on, you know, it's so hurtful to me. I can't watch the news. Yeah. But as a dad, it's hard to watch.
If you could talk to Nicholas now about what's happening, what would you say to him?
I think he would say to me, he was very wise, because I'm not the type to sit on the sidelines. He would say to me, "Dad, let it go. Let it go. It's okay." And what I would say to him is, "I miss you, and I'm proud of you." And I know there's the greatest generation, but this is the next greatest generation. Senator Vilas, they volunteer. Every one of these young men and women from all walks of life, you know, and they volunteered to go. And so what I would tell him is, "I'm proud of you. And yes, I miss you, and it breaks my heart, but we focus on the good." And he never got to tell me about Afghanistan. He just screamed into the phone. He made one phone call, and he screamed in. He said, "Dad, I'm tired." And he fought in Iraq, you know, on the ground. He was infantry. And he said, "I just can't wait to come home. I'm tired." And he said, "It's really bad here." So I, you know, they pushed out. That's called the Summer of Decision. Summer of 2009, President Obama sent 12,000 Marines to Afghanistan during the killing season, which is the summertime. And It was horrible, and Nick's battalion lost 14 men. But they're all brave, and we need to make sure that the ones that made it home know that their service was not in vain, that they helped free a country, they helped let women and children walk the streets, they set the tone for the future, that we are Americans and we will spill our blood all over the world and never take over a country. Just put them back on their feet.
We should all be proud of your son. Representative, I also want to ask you what you've been hearing from other Gold Star families. Have you been talking to them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I try to set them straight because, you know, we're all different. We all grieve differently. For me, it's been 12 years. When it first happened, I was suicidal. I wanted to be with my son, you know, and that's normal. And I'm not shy about that. That's a feeling. But we you know, you fight on, you find a purpose, and the purpose is to help others. And so what I try to tell them is, don't focus on, you know, the bad that we see. That will settle. Shame on the suits in Washington, not the boots on the ground. The boots on the ground did their job. So I try to tell other Gold Star families, stay proud of who you raised, and never let anyone take that away from you or us. That's the way it is. We stick together despite politics. Don't let that get in your way. We stick together. We raised American heroes.
Senator Velez, thinking too of the living, of those seeking refuge now, I'm wondering from your perspective what role Massachusetts should be and is playing in getting folks out, keeping folks safe from Afghanistan, both U.S. service members and Afghans.
I'd be remiss if I didn't just say this. You know, the rep used the word hero. Nicholas is a hero. His family is a hero. Gold Star families are the most precious asset we have in this world. You know, there's all this conversation about right now, you know, U.S. service members, you know, did we win the war? Did we lose the war? Was the sacrifice in vain? And I think that largely misses a point. You know, whatever's happening right now, to quote the rep, that's the suits in Washington, D.C. who did that. The suits have lost this war, not the service members. So what we need to do, you know, our obligation, we need to take care of the Gold Star families. And for those who are coming back with injuries, we do everything we can to take care of them and let them know that their sacrifice will never be in vain. And then we take certain steps, kind of revisiting the letter, to take care of our allies who walked those streets with us, who made it. So the efforts we put in, you know, that's not in vain. Again, the world is watching us. And make no mistake about it, what we do with our allies in Afghanistan right now is something that current, future adversaries are looking at it. The world is watching us to see what we do right now.
So Representative Exaros, Senator Velez just said, you know, it was the suits in Washington who lost this war. Do you agree? And from your perspective, what is the lasting legacy of this war?
Great question. I don't like the sound of that we lost this war. You know, when Nick was killed horribly, it was horrible. But about a month later, President Obama and his wife flew to Cape Cod here and met with me and my wife and my three siblings, Nick's siblings. It wasn't just to shake hands, it was to talk. And he was very, you know, kind and compassionate. And I'll never forget talking with him. He hugged everybody. He said his kind words to my Alex and Elizabeth and Ashlyn and Lisa. And then he pulled me aside, man to man. And he said, I'm about to make my decision about Afghanistan. Now, this is August 2009. And the President of the United States said to me, what do you want me to do? And I told him, you keep fighting. You know, we don't give up. Keep fighting. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, when I make my decision, I will think of Nicholas.
So last question then, Senator Velez. What's next for U.S. service members and our legacy in Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think, I just want to add, I was, you know, really the sentiment that I was expressing was, it wasn't U.S. service members that got us to the point we're at today. I would argue it's virtually impossible to say, did someone win or lose a war, particularly in a place like Afghanistan, such a hybrid environment where you're dealing with things like counterinsurgency, when you're dealing with coin doctrine, you're just dealing with so many things out there. I think what's next is, you know, we need to ensure that everybody is out of there that helped us. And then I think it really involves kind of sitting back and seeing, okay, what's next? What does the new Taliban government do? The message that I'm getting from the folks on the ground is don't believe a word they're saying.
That's State Senator John Velas from the 2nd Hampton and Hampshire District. He did two tours of duty in Afghanistan with the United States Army Reserve. State Senator Velas, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
And State Representative Steve Exaros, he represents the 5th Barnstable District and is the Gold Star father of United States Marine Corporal Nicholas Exaros. Representative, thank you as well.
Thank you. God bless. Live worthy.
Next, let's go to the North End, Boston's oldest neighborhood, with someone who knows quite a bit about old things in Boston.
My name is Joe Bagley, and I'm a city archaeologist and director of archaeology, new title, for the city of Boston.
We met up recently on a perfectly sunny summer day, unlike today. Bagley is the author of a new book, Boston's Oldest Buildings and Where to Find Them, an eclectic collection of the oldest still-standing structures in our city and the stories they tell us about 10,000 years of lived history here. From private homes that you've probably never heard of to ones you most definitely have.
So we are standing just outside of the Paul Revere House, the second oldest house in the city of Boston. And this is one of my first times downtown in almost 2 years now, and really shocked by the number of people that are out and about, which is a good thing, but it's different.
How does it feel? Yeah.
It feels alive. The weather's amazing, and everybody seems happy and glad to be here. I'm happy and glad to be here, so it's definitely mutual.
Let's talk about the Paul Revere House, because, you know, you just said the city feels alive and vibrant again, right? And in some ways, an old building can feel old. So tell us about this building and both its history and then what it means today.
Sure. So, I mean, its history being one of the three remaining 17th century buildings in the entire city of Boston. And because they're so rare, generally, it's one of the few remaining 17th century buildings in the country, really. It is a real piece of what the landscape and the streetscape of Boston felt like 300 plus years ago. And I think that that's really what it brings to this neighborhood, but also brings to the tourism industry. It really is about its continual existence for over 300 years. That's the real story to me, is that it's still here, and it still looks like it does. It has this medieval vibe to it. It's got the tiny windows with the diamond glasses. It's got the slight overhang on the second story, the gigantic chimney.
It's crooked.
Yeah, a little bit. It's been beautifully restored. On top of that, this, from literally where we're standing right now, it's one of the few places, I think, definitely in the city, where you can look at a 17th century, an 18th century, a 19th century, a 20th century, and a 21st century building. Boston hasn't stopped growing, and it's a living city. It's a growing city. It needs to grow. We need to make sure we preserve significant properties so that they can be part of that story. But the reality is we can't put a glass dome over the city and expect that it can survive. But,
So talk to me about that in terms of the Paul Revere House.
Sure.
Because in reading your book, I learned that it wasn't just Paul Revere's house mm-hmm. and then today in the living museum. Mm-hmm. It served many purposes throughout the centuries. Mm-hmm. And that sort of highlighted the changes that were going on in Boston in each time.
And that's something I noticed with all of the buildings in the book, is that they're here basically because they still provided a service and function for the people of Boston. So this started off as a private home. It remained a private home for essentially the first 200 years of its life. Then right around 1800, it turned into a boarding house for recently arrived immigrants and people passing through the area. It's hard to tell now, but we are right on the shoreline of Boston, and within feet of where we're standing was docks and boats and sailors and constant movement of people. So the house, it served many people passing through the neighborhood, and then it transformed to a house museum in 1900, unlike many of the houses in the area, which were then taken down and turned into slightly higher brick row houses, 4, 5, 6 stories that you see now in the North End that kind of make the North End vibe that you feel when you're in the neighborhood. So this one kind of got paused in the 1900s, but it is part of that continuous story. It had storefronts in the front on the first floor, as many of the buildings still do today. And then its purpose went from being purely functional as a living place to as a place of history.
I also wanted to ask you about Boston's complex, complicated history on race and, mm-hmm. and slavery.
Absolutely.
There is something striking. I understand why you have to, you know, make a conceit for a book, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there is something striking about looking at owned property and thinking about who through history was allowed to own property and who was deemed property. So how do you think about that history?
Yeah, and one of the challenges with doing the research and understanding the stories of the buildings in the book is that for many, many, many years, the preservation efforts of both the public and the preservation community were focused on the nicest, the oldest, the fanciest buildings. And those really got emphasized for preservation. Which that means is that the folks who were at the bottom of the social and economic scale, the enslaved people, the widows, children who don't have their own money, their stories and their buildings and their properties were less preserved. And unfortunately, we have fewer of them now to preserve because of that. By going back through the historic records, though, most historic house museums, including the Revere House, are going back through their records to deliberately seek out those underrepresented stories of enslaved people, of minorities, of women, of children, who don't get written about as much. And so by focusing on those stories today, we're filling in all those missing gaps as much as we can. It's a kind of double-edged sword, where it's an important thing to look at today, but we've lost so much information along the way.
You know, our next stop, we're going to walk over to Old North Church, which in recent years has also sort of been going through its records as well and finding where the funding for its steeple came from, for example, was from a rich Boston slave owner, Faneuil Hall, named after Peter Faneuil, notorious slave owner as well. So, slave trader, really.
Slave merchant, yeah.
Slave merchant. So, I guess I'm wondering, so in your research for these buildings, did you find records of both who built them and how they were paid for?
Mm-hmm. Most of the time, the information about who built them specifically, who the actual laborers were, was hidden under a layer of many of the owners were themselves builders. So they were tradespeople, bricklayers, housewrights. They may have enslaved people who were then used as laborers on the properties that were being built. With the buildings, what we get for the ones that are still standing are primarily people who were enslavers themselves. We only have one building in the top 50 that was actually built for a black person. That's the Glampion Middleton House on Beacon Hill. The rest of them may have had black people living in these houses, but not for their first couple of centuries where they lived in and occupied by free black Bostonians.
So as we think about preserving these historic sites, how should we also think about then telling the stories of all of the people involved?
I think it just comes down to, well, you have to consciously choose to tell those stories because there's so much information that we now know about these buildings. There's so much research that's gone into this, not my own necessarily, but other people's as well. If you look at the spaces that are in the backs of buildings, the spaces that are in the attics, the spaces that are on the second floors of churches, that's where you get that other story. But it is a conscious choice, and that's important, and that's one of the things that is really happening right now that may not have happened decades ago, but it's a good step in the right direction.
I wonder, too, you know, you included it in your honorable mentions section, the indigenous fish weir, which were here 3600 BCE. Yeah. Tell us about those.
So one of the things that I had to do with the book was to set parameters about what I would define as a building. So I had to do things like it had to have a roof. It couldn't just be a foundation. And that was to rule out a bunch of things like a lot of tombs and walls and things like that, or staircases that are preserved that are out and about but not part of houses. With the fish weirs, it didn't have a roof, but it is a structure. It is a building technically, but not in the terms of what people I think would expect to see in the book. But for me, it was really important to acknowledge that not only are the fish weirs an important building in the history of Boston, but it's the oldest building that we know in this region. They've been here for 5,000 years in some cases. Incredibly important, one of the largest man-made structures in the country. That goes back that far.
Can you describe them?
Sure, yeah. So the native fish weirs, built by the Massachusetts people here in Boston, were built by taking saplings and small pieces of tree branches and things like that, and hammering them into the clay in Back Bay at low tide, thousands of years before Back Bay was filled. So at low tide, you could walk out onto a mud flat and build these fence-like structures. And at high tide, especially in the spring, the sea would cover them up completely, and fish that would swim up the rivers, like alewives, herring, would swim up the Charles River, spawn upriver, Watertown, that area, and then come back down the Charles River. At low tide, the water would go down, and now the fences are officially out of the water in that 2-3 foot of water, and the fish would be captured behind the fences, and the native people would be standing there in their canoes or on foot, capturing by the thousands fish and drying them on the common. And there's thousands of pieces of the weir still under Back Bay. They were first found over 100 years ago, and they've popped up a few times since during construction projects, and something we actively look for when projects are proposed in Back Bay.
I love that you included that, because it also reminds us of the history of the land itself. Yeah. where these buildings are.
Yeah, and Boston has, if you open a book about Boston history, and it starts with in 1630, close the book, because most of that story has already been ignored. The reality is the history, the human story of Boston begins at least 10,000 years ago with Native people, and that first 10,000 years of history represents over 97% of the storyline of Boston. So if you want to read the last page of the book, then read a book that starts in 1630.
Do you mind if we walk over to Absolutely. Old North?
Sure, yeah, that's it.
I'm going to follow you so that I don't trip here on the cobblestone.
The nice thing about doing the old buildings in Boston is that you basically follow the Freedom Trail and you'll hit most of them until you get to the outer neighborhoods.
So now we're walking just along the side of the church here.
These are all the original bricks, too.
They're in great shape.
Bricks are in good shape. The mortar's been replaced a few times. That tends to be the first thing to go. But yeah, the bricks look good. Probably built out of Medford bricks. Probably by enslaved people, though.
Any connection to the royal family?
Probably. I don't know if it's a direct reference, but we don't know if there were enslaved people involved in the project, but it would be pretty surprising if there weren't. That kind of labor data is not well recorded. I believe, though, that the church is really looking into that kind of information, trying to see if it could be found anywhere, because it is an important part of that story.
Should that change how we think about it?
The story of enslavement is part of the history of Boston, and it's not just Old North. The people of Boston in the 1700s, the wealthy people especially, were directly involved in the direct enslavement of people. The people who lived in Boston who were not enslaving people were buying goods made by enslaved people. They were relying on the economy that was supported by enslaved people. There is no innocent person in the 18th century Boston that is a freed person who's benefiting from the economy that hasn't had some benefit from enslavement. So if you point the finger at one or two symbols and say that needs to go because of that story, what I think is really, really more important than trying to put all of the blame on one or two things is to better understand how pervasive, ubiquitous enslavement was in this to the history of Boston.
What do you hope people learn from your book, learn from looking at just the sampling of 50 buildings, and learn from Boston's history?
It's not all sunshine and roses, but the parts that aren't sunshine and roses are interesting, important, and need to be told and need to be considered, thought about, memorialized, and come to terms with. There's a lot of exciting, fun, funny things that happened in the book. There's a lot of exciting, fun, and funny things that happened in Boston's history. But I think in 2021, we're, as a community, as a nation, really stopping and saying, we need to check ourselves and make sure that we are not overlooking people who were oppressed in time and past and are still oppressed today because of the legacy of that oppression. We don't only have to talk about the bad, but if we don't consider the bad with the good, we are deliberately choosing to do so at this point. We can no longer hide our heads in the sand and say that history, we don't really understand it or get it, or it's not really out there.
It's not findable.
Yeah, it's findable. It's out there. It's been talked about. It's being talked about. The folks that are involved with these organizations at Old North, Paul Revere, and all these other places are actively going after this history to make sure that the public knows about it. They're coming to terms with it. They're reckoning it. And all of them really are trying to make actionable moves to address it, correct it, and make some sort of change because of it.
Well, Joe, thank you for your time today. Yeah,
thank you for coming out here and for enjoying this beautiful day.
That was Joe Bagley, the city archaeologist and director of archaeology for Boston. He's also author of the new book, Boston's Oldest Buildings and Where to Find Them. And it's almost that time of day.
It's peanut butter jelly time! Peanut butter jelly time! Peanut butter jelly time! Where you at? Where you at? Where you at? Where you at? There you go! There you go! There you go! There you go! Peanut butter jelly!
Oh, that's right. It's time to talk turkey and ham and PB&J and really whatever other kinds of sandwiches you like from arguably Hollywood's most famous sandwich.
I'll have what she's having.
To our favorite bready aphrodisiacs.
I guess we could use some food in our lovemaking.
Okay, we got your pastrami on rye with mustard. Your honey.
Wait. Pastrami on rye with mustard?
Oh, yeah. Don't you remember they used pastrami in that movie 9 1/2 Weeks? Remember the pastrami scene?
No.
Well, maybe it was Ghostbusters. Whatever it was, it worked.
I honestly can't believe you guys let me do this kind of thing. It's all on the table, so to speak, and we want to hear from you, listeners. What's your favorite sandwich? What, with all the extra time at home over the last year and a half, have you perfected any new favorites or revisited old ones, visited new places going out there in the city? Call us. Join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us now to help celebrate the art of the sandwich are two friends of the show, Irene Lee, owner and head chef of May May Restaurant Group in Boston. Hey, Irene.
Hello, Mr. Bologna.
Yeah, I got the name for this one, don't I? Also joining us is Joe Gatto, local chef, culinary instructor, and host of From Scratch on Pluto TV. Hello, Joe.
Sandwiches, so exciting.
Please, indulge me. Have you been revisiting old favorites, Joe?
Oh, I mean, I'm a sandwich freak. Like, get a restraining order, you know, because I love the sandwich. And I actually just spent a couple weeks doing a sandwich. I was making bacon from scratch. So I made 5 pounds of homemade espresso chipotle bacon and then made a BLT from scratch. So I made a mayo, I made the bread, I made the bacon, and I have to say it was worth all that time.
5 weeks?
It just took forever because you have to cure the bacon and you're letting the bacon rest. It was 9 days. And,
wow.
You know, a 9-day sandwich better be worth it. And this bad boy was worth it.
Irene, what?
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask Irene.
No, I'm just
kind
of freaking out still.
I really can't believe 9 days to make a sandwich. Usually I think of a sandwich as something that's fast. So, Irene, what have you been perfecting?
I think I've been revisiting the opposite of the 9-day sandwich, which is the peanut butter and jelly. I was at a farmer's market and picked up this incredible jar of Concord grape jelly from Grateful Jams. And it was, you know, the pinnacle of all Concord grape jelly. So I had to make a PB&J with it.
And what did you use for the peanut butter?
I like the Santa Cruz chunky peanut butter, a little bit of crunch, and I usually get it salted. This time I got it unsalted, and so I added some smoked flaky sea salt to it, which was pretty exciting.
I mean, but PB&J, really? Okay, I guess what makes a good sandwich? I'm clearly being a little judgy here. Sorry, Irene, but I kind of go in with the bacon sandwich right now. So what makes a good sandwich in your mind?
In my mind, a sandwich is all about having the right mix of flavors and textures. So I like toasted bread. I like chunky peanut butter. I like super smooth jelly. And yeah, I mean, the PB&J is a little bit lowbrow, but, you know, my husband likes to joke that it's time for me to open an artisanal peanut butter and jelly sandwich restaurant.
People would go.
To culturally appropriate backwards, I suppose. So, you know, $25 for local Concord grape jelly. But for me, there's something super comforting about it. And actually, I was watching my nephew on FaceTime eating one, and that made me jealous. And that's how I kind of ended up on this kick.
1-800-423-8255 is the phone number. We're going to go to Ed in Burlington. Ed, you're next on Radio Boston.
Yeah, I just love a good cheesesteak sandwich. They're difficult to find here in Boston, even though I lived here 30 years, but I love them. From,
when you say cheesesteak,
Carl Steaks and Waltham.
Carl Steaks and Waltham. When you say cheesesteak, do you mean like sort of Philly style or steak and cheese with mushrooms and onions and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, from, well, less Philly style, more like the second.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. All right. Sounds delicious. I mean, so does a sandwich, Joe, does it have to have meat? I mean, I know Irene's been talking about a PB&J here. Ed's talking about a cheesesteak. You had your bacon sandwich. Is meat what makes it next level sandwich?
I mean, you know, it doesn't have to have meat. I'm a big believer in it, you know, but it's really what you want to shove in your pie hole. You know, what makes you happy, what gets you through the day, what puts a smile on your face. I love a good steak and cheese as well, but, you know, I'm not a guy that would turn down a PB&J either. You know, I love a good PB&J, but I definitely am a big believer in the meat sandwich, like, you know, like an Italian or something like that. I'm definitely that kind of guy. I love that kind of thing.
Let's go to Steven in Somerville. Steven, you're next on Radio Boston. What's your sandwich?
Hey, so I was trying to eat a little bit healthier over the pandemic, and so I started making a vegetarian sandwich that I learned about from a place called Cafe Vesuvius up in Marblehead. And so it's on either like a sourdough or French bread, something that you toast and get nice and crispy. And then you do a provolone cheese melt, and then you put some avocado spread on there. Ooh. And top it off with some sprouts, green peppers, onions. I like red onions, some really crispy lettuce, tomato, and then a little olive oil, vinegar, maybe some ground pepper on top of it. And it's absolutely amazing. And I know you guys were asking if a sandwich needed to have meat. Usually I feel it's the case, but this sandwich completely takes the day with no meat.
Yeah, Steven, give the producer your phone number. We'll be coming over to your house later. That sounds good. Although I do have to be honest here, Irene, Joe, when I heard we were doing this segment today, I'm not the world's biggest sandwich fan, and maybe it's my last name. Maybe it's a little sort of brought, you know, childhood trauma of the spelling of my last name. But for me, it's like if I'm going to have a meal, then I want it over pasta. Is that crazy? Tell me I'm wrong.
I mean, I don't think you're crazy, but you're definitely wrong. I'm just like, you know, for me, I just like a sandwich during the day. That's the go-to for me. And I, you know, for when I'm creating meals for my clients or anything, I, you know, and I have some filet and there's some extra filet, I'm always making a sandwich and like dipping it in the jus. Like I love a little bread and meat like that. From it just really satisfies my soul.
Irene, you're famous for one of your sandwich creations, the Double Awesome, which I have had, and it is doubly awesome. So can you just remind us what goes into that and how that came about?
Yeah, the Double Awesome is a scallion pancake sandwich. So it's that laminated flaky scallion pancake folded in half. It has two oozy eggs, melted cheddar cheese, and a green pesto sauce. And we like to serve it with spicy ketchup. And I think we've put our egg farmers' kids through college, at least one of them. It's an incredibly popular sandwich, and we managed to convince a lot of people that just because it has eggs in it doesn't mean you can't eat it for lunch or dinner. It's so much more than a breakfast sandwich.
It is delicious and runny, and it's doubly awesome. That's a perfect title for it. 1-800-423-8255 is the phone number. Share with us your pandemic sandwich creations or where you've been going out to get sandwiches and what have you been getting. Again, 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Anna in Walpole. Anna, you're next on Radio Boston.
Hi. The sandwich I've really worked on through the pandemic is pretty much the Eggs Benedict or Eggs Florentine or anything that's had a poached egg. Really nice toasted English muffin. I really like working on making that poached egg, really that perfect with a runny inside, working over that nicely toasted English muffin so that it's just perfect with the right number of ingredients in the middle so that it's just that perfect either breakfast or brunch type thing that she really is satisfying to get you started in the day.
Sounds great. It's the hollandaise sauce that I think takes a lot of work. I mean, Joe, are there any tips to perfect that?
I mean, I think that's a pretty easy sauce. It's just always getting the emulsion to hold.
Right.
So you just have to take it really slow and just, you know, take your time with something like that. That's the key to a lot of like sauces. It's just take your time and perfect it. Don't rush it. That's the time you should just be zenning out, not texting, not Instagramming, not doing anything. Just concentrate on the sauce for a little while and it'll pay off. And a big thing for me is I always double the sauces around here because we use it on everything like chimichurri, that I make here, we put on every sandwich possible, but we put on eggs and everything else. So it's just a good go-to to kind of pep up a regular meal.
Hmm. Marie is calling from Bolton. Marie, you're next on Radio Boston.
Hey, so the sandwich that I rediscovered over the COVID shutdown was something my dad had all the time. It was a butter and peanut butter sandwich.
Butter and peanut butter? Like melty butter?
Butter and peanut butter. Yeah. Yeah, well, you took, basically, you took about a half tablespoon of butter, and you layered those over every square inch of your bread, which is, you know, cheesy white bread. Not cheesy with cheese, but inexpensive white bread. And
right.
Then you did an equal layer on the other side of peanut butter, and you slapped them together and cut them on the diagonal. And then you'd be consuming enough fat for a week, but they are really good.
Would hold you through any winter storm. That sounds interesting, Marie. Thanks for sharing. I want to squeeze one more in here. We got Jack from Somerville. Jack, you're next on Radio Boston.
Hey, guys. I'd love to share with you my favorite sandwich. It's a great sandwich to have in the summer. The steak and cheese lobster roll.
So, go on.
Okay, so every summer, about this time of year, actually, usually lobster prices drop, and it hasn't happened this year or last year, but I always look forward to this time of year, go to Market Basket, get a lobster for me and, you know, a couple for friends. I like to cook the lobster over directly on a campfire, if you just on your charcoal grill in the backyard, shell the lobster, chop it up, reheat it in a little bit of butter, toast some soft bread. Also get from Market Basket just some shaved steak. Saute it in a pan and get a nice alpine cheese like Gruyere or Comté and slam it all in the bun together and feel your heart flow.
Wow. Jack, you know, you almost got me there, but I feel like they're just two separate things. So, Irene, how can we think about taking things that seemingly don't go together? I'm thinking peanut butter and butter or steak and cheese and lobster and just make them delicious.
I think Jack is living it up. I mean, that's like a surf and turf sandwich. I think there are a lot of different ways to think about flavor combinations. I love thinking of butter as a sandwich ingredient and not just kind of an accoutrement. Like, you can eat enough butter to make it one of the headlining ingredients in the sandwich. That's pretty awesome for me. But I think that, again, it comes back to just making sure the textures and flavors work for you. I think if lobster, steak, and cheese works for Jack, I'm all about that.
So we put this topic out on Twitter this morning, and right away folks started chiming in. WBUR's Megan McGinnis, who sends out the WBUR newsletters, she said she feels the Monte Cristo is, quote, one of the most underrated sandwiches of all time. Joe, do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's underrated. I mean, I love Monte Cristo, and I think that's just a great sandwich. I wouldn't call that one underrated. I would think that's kind of right where it should be.
And you dip it in the syrup and you go.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's a must, right?
So tips for folks who are opening the fridge, looking what's in there and saying, all right, how can I make this work? Irene.
Well, I always think that if you want to make a really balanced sandwich, it's good to have something a little bit sweet, something tart, like a pickle. And I always like a little bit of hot sauce in a sandwich. So a lot of the time I'll start in the fridge door to kind of see what I've got kicking around. And then really anything, any veggie sandwiches are great for leftovers. Constructing a sandwich that has all of the stuff that has hung out in my fridge for a little too long, putting the right hot
just
sauce and
flirting
and
with the end there, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. You know, between two slices of bread, anything is possible. So for me, I think a lot about textures and then having something sweet, something tart, something a little bit spicy. And that's sort of where I begin.
Well, let's see if we can squeeze one more call in here. Andre is calling from Pelham, New Hampshire. Andre, you're next.
Hi, how you doing? You're talking something near and dear to my heart. Love sandwiches.
It's near and dear to your stomach, right?
Oh, that too. My COVID garden has given me a bountiful bounty of tomatoes. I have revisited the tomato sandwich, and my latest favorite is toasted wheat with horseradish mayo, a little bit of avocado, a couple of slices of bacon, and a big old slice of tomato. Oh, yes.
That sounds good. Get some burrata up in there, too.
That sounds awesome.
Thanks for the call, Andre. So, I guess I'm just wondering from both of you each, what you would suggest to folks who maybe were like me before this segment, who are like, sandwiches aren't my jam. Bring us on board.
I get it. Not my jam. I get it.
I did not intend that, Joe.
I'm with you. I'm with you. You're trying to butter me up. I get it. You know, I would just say things that you like to eat, try to invent a sandwich with it. You know, like, I mean, we do one. I make a pistachio pesto at home that gets consumed with everything. And we do pulled chicken sandwiches with the pistachio pesto on a little, like, garlic bread, you know, just for a quick sandwich. So it's like a meal we've had, but we just kind of recreate it into a sandwich. I think that makes it really fun. And I have three young kids, so they always like to create in the kitchen. So it's always fun to pull out ingredients and know that they like them and just create something with it.
Irene?
I would say, you know, if it's not a meal, if there's no pasta involved, just put the pasta in the sandwich.
I can do that?
Classic. you know, potato chips in the sandwich, potato salad in a sandwich. If it's more carbs that you need, I'm not opposed to a carb sandwich.
Carb on carb is okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I just needed your permission. You guys are chefs. Pierogi? It's okay. Let's see if I can squeeze in Lisa here and give her the last word real quick. Lisa in Cohasset, you're next on Radio Boston.
Hey, everybody. So the Welcome Center on 93 in New Hampshire has the most amazing grilled cheese sandwiches. My favorite being a Gruyere cheese with a fig spread, and then they grill it like a panini on sourdough bread, and it is unbelievable. It's
the
got
Welcome
that
Center.
Sweet taste that you're talking about. Yeah.
Wow.
It's the rest stop on Route 93 in New Hampshire. There are multiple Welcome Centers.
Gotta say, I wasn't expecting a sandwich from a Welcome Center there, Lisa, but thank you for the phone call. I guess it's highbrow and lowbrow. You can get sandwiches everywhere, right, folks?
Damn right. Yeah, for sure.
Well, that's Joe Gatto. He's a local chef, culinary instructor, and host of From Scratch on Pluto TV. Joe, it's always great to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a blast. Sandwiches rock, and so do you.
Well, thank you. And I'll make one tonight for dinner. Irene Lee, owner and head chef of Mei Mei Restaurant Group in Boston. Thank you for joining as well.
Thank you. Put some spaghetti in there, okay?
Yeah, I will. And folks, the back tag here, we got some music. It's Sandwich Time, Sandwiches Time by Weezer. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. It's produced by Chris Siderick, Walter Withman, Amanda Beeland, Cynthia Bitubiza. We had help from Ali Audette and Stephen Gelman. Marquise Neal is our technical director. David, the Cavs of Belleville Green, was on phones. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Jamie Bologna. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.